ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
How do you feel about pasta, bread, all things gluten, Norman?
Love it.
Oh, me too.
Consume it in vast quantities.
So do I. I think if someone said to me that I couldn't have pasta and bread, I would be quite devastated.
Yeah. But a lot of people are avoiding it because they feel that they are reacting to the gluten in those substances. I mean, it's much easier to be a bit gluten-free these days because there are more products on the supermarket
shelves. Yes, so many options.
But I remember once I was doing a session at the Sydney Writers' Festival on food and diet and cooking and so on, and it was a big audience, maybe 800 or 900 people, and I asked people to put up their hands if they were gluten intolerant or gluten sensitive. And about 40% of the audience put up their hands.
40?
Big. You know, it was just like, maybe that's where you go when you're gluten intolerant. You go to the Sydney Writers' Festival. I'm being a bit intolerant of people who say that they're intolerant. But the statistics aren't that high. So something, it's not that those symptoms that people are getting aren't real, but it's probably not gluten.
That is exactly what we're covering on the Health Report today. People can have really significant symptoms in their gut, outside the gut. What are they actually reacting to? That's what we're going to cover.
I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
And I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
Also on the show, a common antibiotic used to treat acne might reduce the risk of schizophrenia in young people. It's an amazing study and could have very significant implications if it's right.
We often talk about what it takes to diagnose cancer and then treat it, but up to 50% is preventable.
Yeah, but are we doing anything about that 50% or doing enough? That's another question. Because I'm speaking with the director of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, that's based in Lyon, in particular about the causes of these rises in cancer in young people and what we don't like to hear about alcohol.
In the news, the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has just released government spending on public health activities in Australia.
So for those of you who don't know, the AIHW, the Australian Health Institute of Health and Welfare, gathers statistics on the health system and the social system and publishes them from time to time, and they do special studies. And they would call themselves independent in terms of the statistics and just call out what's actually happening in the system. And in this case, as you say, it's prevention.
So yeah, this is public health spending on preventing disease, promoting health initiatives. It's not about treating any condition. What this report has shown is that the spending on prevention has dropped back to pre-pandemic levels.
Yeah. So we should really talk about what constitutes public health spending, because you might just think, well, that's about anti-smoking, it's about people getting exercise and better nutrition and so on. Well, in fact, most of the expenditure does not go on that.
Where does it go?
Well, it goes, most 44% goes on immunisation activities. So that's called prevention. There are also monitoring activities in terms of, you know, the food supply and other things that are there in terms of public health activities. In fact, what are spent on campaigns and public education campaigns are a small part. And as you say, we've retreated back to pre-pandemic levels, so not even accounting for an increase in those years.
Yes. And I'm about to get very passionate here, because I do feel that we should be putting a lot more money into prevention and public health campaigning. And we just rolled out the RSV vaccine in Australia in pregnancy this year. And there wasn't, we did talk about it, there wasn't an amazing public health campaign to support that. People still are only eating under the recommended fruit and veg intake, are unaware of the benefits of physical activity. I just think, Norman, how have we reduced the amount of money being pumped into this by $2.3 billion from 2022 to 2023? That's the reduction that's been seen, when we still have so much that we could do in this space. And I'm a GP sitting in the consulting room thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if people had more information on prevention?
Yeah. And it's how the money is spent. So I would argue, so I can say this because
yes,
I'm not a GP,
yeah,
But I would argue that general practice is part of prevention. If a part of prevention is actually stopping people getting acutely ill, seriously ill, ending up in hospital, then general practice is part of that. But in fact, general practice is very poorly funded for preventative activities. You're cycling fast to do the regular stuff with people who are acutely ill. And that's about state governments. You know, get me on my hobby horse.
Oh, yeah, this is your hobby horse now. Go on.
Well, my hobby horse is we sort of have a split system where the Commonwealth funds general practice, funds drugs, for example, and the state system funds hospitals. And you have misaligned incentives. So every GP wants to prevent people getting into hospital and getting them sick. But the incentive is for the state government to actually invest in that, whether or not it's part of the same system, to actually reduce demand on hospitals. Yet state systems focus inordinately on the hospital system and waiting lists and building new hospitals. And maybe I'm on my hobby horse here, but we should be broadening the idea of what is public health activities and what is prevention. And it's quite a narrow approach. And 7 out of 10 Australians, you know, talking about public health activities, want gambling advertising banned, and we don't do that. And that's a cost-free implementation. And in a moment or two in the health report, you're going to find out about alcohol. There's a cost-free policy to reduce alcohol consumption, and they don't do it.
And can I just, because we're both getting very passionate here, and I was trying to jump in, Norman.
But
we are in an age where people are being exposed to more and more confusing health misinformation, disinformation. We know vaccine rates are declining. There's some hesitancy, confusion. You know, all of this is happening at a time when people need reliable information more than ever. So I think we're both saying, I think the same thing, do you think?
Yeah, it's just you've got to build, you know, the old metaphor, rather than sending the ambulance to the bottom of the cliff, you build a fence at the top of the cliff, and we are spending less money on the fence.
A new study this week published in Lancet Child and Adolescent Health, which has really highlighted how common high blood pressure issues are in childhood.
Yeah, this was a review of the available evidence. So they looked at multiple studies across the world to see if they could assess what changes have occurred to the prevalence of high blood pressure in children. This is really difficult to do. It's not easy to measure blood pressure in children. You've got to get the size of the cuff right. The child has got to be settled down. It's hard.
Yes.
It's hard enough in adults to do an accurate blood pressure test, much less in children. So I don't know, but I presume you don't do that often because it's so hard.
Well, that's right. And I was reading this paper, which essentially said we should be doing more in-office, out-of-office blood pressure readings. You know, the stats from this are essentially that high blood pressure in children and adolescents nearly doubled between 2000 and 2020. So it's much more prevalent than what we think. We think more children have masked hypertension, so they have a normal reading inside the clinic room. Outside of the clinic when they're at home, actually they do have high blood pressure. This has serious implications. This can impact heart disease risk, kidney disease risk. It also impacts their health trajectory in adulthood. The question I ask Norman is, am I missing something? Because I'm not doing that many blood pressures on children, A, because it's difficult, and B, I went back and checked the guidelines for GPs and it's not really recommended under age 15 to 19. That's when we're meant to start thinking about it, according to the preventative health guidelines.
Yeah, you know, it's a sleeper of an issue. But if you've got high blood pressure in adolescence, there is this phenomenon where in the research which suggests that high blood pressure in earlier childhood tends to even off after the age of 14, which actually might be a measurement thing, where it's actually easier to measure blood pressure when you've got an older child and it's more like an adult cuff there. But nonetheless, if you've got persistent blood pressure, you need to find out why. The child could have kidney disease or develop kidney disease as a result of the high blood pressure, and because you're going to get this battering away for years of their life. But you can identify children who are more likely to have high blood pressure, and those are kids who are overweight and obese, who are also the kids where it's hard to measure the blood pressure. So there needs to be easier ways for this to be done in the clinic and done reliably. And to that point about masked high blood pressure, most people listening would have heard of maybe white coat hypertension, where your blood pressure goes up when you see the GP because you're anxious and your blood pressure goes up.
Which does have implications, by the way. We don't ignore that anymore.
No, because you do it at home. You get them to do it at home?
We do it at home, but the suggestion is now that if your blood pressure is able to go up that high in the consulting room, that it is probably a factor, that there is an underlying...
So it might be real.
Yeah, correct. Yep. Can I just say, in Australia, though, there is a group called BP Oz Kids, which has been developed by Hypertension Australia and Murdoch Children's Research Institute, and there are guidelines coming in this space. So it may well be that whilst at the moment we're not checking that many blood pressures in children, that might change.
So all parents of young kids listening, stay listening. We'll have more updates for you. Not something to panic about, because it is about anticipatory treatment over the child's lifetime, but it's important to be aware of the issue.